This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. We're going to start this week's show by talking about baseball's All-Star Game, or not really about the game, but about one player we think you might want to pay attention to on Tuesday night. Lots of the players in that game are established stars with big contracts, and they're accustomed to the spotlight. But this player, he's a pitcher for the American League, is probably pinching himself. Until just this year, he didn't know if he'd make it to the major leagues, let alone the All-Star Game. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story of the long journey of pitcher Stephen Wright.
It's a hot summer night in 2010, and Stephen Wright is on a coach bus driving from, let's say, Akron, Ohio to Trenton, New Jersey. As the bus rumbles out of town, Wright takes his usual spot in the center aisle between the seats.
I would get like a little A-crate, like foam pads or whatever, and take an Ambien and wake up when we get there.
Back then, Wright was a minor league pitcher in the Cleveland Indians system.
Most of it sucked. You're traveling through the night, getting in at 7, 8 in the morning, playing that night in front of not too many fans. You're not getting paid anything. You don't get paid. I think my first W-2 was like $9,000 for the year.
5 years earlier, Wright was one of the best college pitchers in the country. His fastball reached the mid-90s. But the most important baseball Stephen Wright tossed that year wasn't to a batter.
We met in the dorms in Honolulu.
That's Shannon. She and Stephen had been friends since freshman year at the University of Hawaii. But Stephen was keeping a secret. He wanted to be more than friends. During his last year of school, he hadn't seen Shannon around much until she showed up to one of his baseball games.
So he saw me and tried to motion, you know, where have you been? Probably somewhere around the fifth inning of a game. I couldn't believe that he was actually paying attention to me during a game, but wrote his number on a baseball and threw it up to me. That was the beginning of actually hanging out again, and then slowly started the dating process.
Spoiler alert, they got married. And in the 2006 MLB draft, the Indians picked Wright in the second of 50 rounds. But 5 years later, Wright was still in the minors, still spending nights asleep in the center aisle of a bus. That fastball that had worked so well in college wasn't fast enough in the pros. In danger of being released from the team, Wright turned to a trick pitch, one he had thrown while playing catch with Shannon, but never in a game.
Every now and then he would throw it at me and he would just laugh at my reaction, and I hated it.
The pitch was the knuckleball. Thrown correctly, the ball flutters unexpectedly and can fool even the best hitters. Throw it wrong, and it's likely to land in the seats. Wright first saw the pitch when he was 9 years old. Former Cincinnati Reds pitcher Frank Pastore showed it to him. Pastore became a close friend and mentor, and they worked together while Wright was in college and in the minors. And in 2010, the knuckleball became Wright's last shot at a major league career.
I had nothing else to do, to be honest with you. It just got to the point where it was kind of a last resort.
The knuckleball would take some time to develop, and soon a minor league salary wasn't going to cut it. Because in July of 2011, Shannon was diagnosed with a tumor.
I was told that it was impossible to have kids.
The Indians flew Stephen out to be with his wife while she underwent testing.
Thankfully, it was non-cancerous. Well, a surprise to everybody, 3 months later, 3 or 4 months later after treatment, I found out that I was pregnant. So then we started freaking out because we weren't ready and we weren't planned or prepared for that.
Had a baby on the way, and I'm like, dude, I was literally going to quit because there's no way you can raise a family making the money that minor leaguers get paid.
What was he going to do instead?
No idea.
But before giving up, Wright wanted to give his knuckleball one last shot. By that point, the Indians had traded him to the Boston Red Sox. He was scheduled to play winter ball in the Dominican Republic. If he could pitch well enough to land a spot on the Red Sox 40-man roster, Wright decided he wouldn't quit baseball.
I just kept praying that the opportunity would come up to just keep him in the game.
Then in November,
he called me and I could hear the excitement in his voice. And at the same time, I was trying not to fall apart and cry when I answered the phone.
Just moments before Stephen called to say that he'd made the 40-man roster, Shannon had learned that Frank Pastore, the man who had first shown the knuckleball to Stephen, had been in a motorcycle crash. A month later, Pastore died.
He was an incredible man. He was Stephen's best friend. He was a mentor. He was a second father. It's hard that he's not here to see him now, but super thankful that he was there when the transition started.
7 years after he was drafted by the Indians, 3 years after he made that transition to the knuckleball, and 4 months after Pastore's death, Stephen Wright, at the age of 28, made his first big league appearance for the Boston Red Sox.
That is strike three. First strikeouts in the major leagues for Stephen Wright, and he will keep that baseball.
It took until this year for Wright to make the starting rotation. Midway through the 2016 season, he's allowing fewer runs than all but one pitcher in the American League. What's been different about this year?
Honestly, dude, I have no idea. I've been asked that question before. I couldn't tell you how many times, and I honestly have no idea.
As Bill Littlefield would say, that's the nature of the knuckleball. Earlier this week, Wright learned he'd be an all-star. Presumably, he won't be taking a bus to San Diego. Shannon says her husband was thrilled.
I don't want to say he was dancing, but it was pretty close. He was definitely excited.
Joining Shannon at the All-Star game will be Frank Pastore's widow.
And we're just so thankful that she's still around to be a part of it.
Because the knuckleball doesn't cause as much strain on the arm as other pitches, Wright might be able to go into his 40s and start cashing some bigger paychecks. This year he's earning just above the major league minimum of about $500,000 a year. But Stephen Wright might not be interested in a long career.
The one thing I don't want to miss is raising my kids. You know, I don't want to look back when they're, you know, 18, 19 years old and be like, where did time go? So it comes to a point where the game starts to affect that, then I'm done. Like, it's not one of those things that I'm not going to hang on until I'm 45 just because I can.
This doesn't surprise Shannon, who gave birth to the couple's second child last year.
No, that's why I married him. He's always said it's God, then family, then baseball. He's been very true to his word and has always made it that way. No matter what has come up in our life, it's always been that way.
Stephen and Shannon's children are too young to appreciate Tuesday's All-Star game. But Shannon already knows what she hopes her kids will one day take away from their father's story.
I hope they learn the value in the struggle. And I hope they realize that no matter who's doubting them, to never give up on themselves. And to know that after all that he's experienced, that they are his greatest success.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
The All-Star break is, among other things, a break. And a break is a good time for stories, and baseball stories are as good as any and better than most. Ted Williams was as good a hitter as any and better than most, and by his own loud and consistent estimation, the best of them all. This is the story of the day upon which the best hitter of them all, by his own estimation, saw a pitch he never wanted to see again and said so. Pat Jordan wrote the story some years ago and put it in a book titled The Suitors of Spring, and it's okay that this was some years ago because it is the kind of story that sticks with you and then comes up on breaks, or at least it does with me. One day at a spring training site that's probably been abandoned and reoccupied several times since this story happened 50 or more years ago, Ted Williams was induced to step into the batter's box while a man named Steve Dalkowski was on the mound. Steve Dalkowski might have been the Ted Williams of pitching if he'd been able to find home plate more than occasionally, but he couldn't, which is another story that may or may not creep into this one as it rolls along, because some of the ways people tried to help Steve Dalkowski harness his fastball are amusing. Ah, what the heck. Some coach had Dalkowski try throwing strikes from halfway between the mound and the plate, which, as it turned out, he could no more do than he could throw them from the mound. Anyway, Steve Dalkowski, who bounced around in the minor leagues for the Orioles for a while, is said to have been able to throw a baseball well over 100 miles an hour. The measurement of fastballs during those days was perhaps not entirely reliable, which could also be said of the people who have passed down the stories of Dalkowski and also of storytellers in general. Somebody convinced Ted Williams that he should step up to the plate and examine briefly a pitch thrown by Dalkowski. The convincing part probably wasn't difficult. How could Ted Williams not have been curious about this fellow who was alleged to have the fastest of fastballs? As Pat Jordan tells the story, Williams watched one Dalkowski fastball cross the plate at his knees, a rare strike, and then he stepped out of the box and he dropped his bat, and that's when he said, "That's the fastest pitch I've ever seen, and I don't want to see it again." Williams probably didn't like the story. I think Pat Jordan did like it because he, like Steve Dalkowski, had a terrific fastball and never made it to the major leagues. I don't know if any coach ever had Jordan throw baseballs against a wooden fence until he'd broken it into pieces, but Delkowski is alleged to have done that. Pat Jordan became a writer whose success has far exceeded his success on the mound. Steve Delkowski became an alcoholic and is currently suffering from dementia, or so says Wikipedia. Ted Williams became frozen and his head was separated from his body, though I don't know if it was in that order. And I host only a game, and none of that story would apply to me unless I had once stood at a plate to look at a fastball that may have been as fast as any Steve Delkowski ever threw. It was thrown by a pitcher who was about 30 feet closer to me than Steve Delkowski had been to the plate when he discouraged Ted Williams. The pitcher's name was Owen Fogg Walford. He dominated fast-pitch softball, which is a misnomer because the ball is hard and it hurts if it hits you, especially if it's traveling at 100 miles an hour. When I encountered Fogg Walford about 35 years ago, he was warming up before an exhibition game that might have been about to be rained out on a muddy field north of Boston. Very few people were there. For the hell of it, I asked Walford's catcher if I could stand at the plate with an imaginary bat, and the catcher shrugged and said, it won't bother him. For one pitch, Fogg Walford would be Steve Delkowski and I would be Ted Williams. I was playing fast-pitch softball at least once a week at the time, so in a vague sort of way, I knew what to expect. Until I didn't. The one pitch looked like a knee-high fastball as it began to arrive, and the next thing I knew, it was a couple of inches under my chin. I'd misjudged it by 2.5 feet. I never wanted to see it again. And that is the story of everything I have in common with Ted Williams. I'm Bill Littlefield. A few minutes ago, we gave you a great reason to tune in to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game on Tuesday, and now we're going to tell you all about how the All-Star Game is a bad deal for fans. That's up first on this week's Three Stories You Should Know. I'm joined this time around by Craig Calcaterra of NBCSports.com and Shira Springer of the Boston Globe. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Craig, you get to start. Off you go.
Well, the All-Star Game is got a long and rich history. It used to be about seeing players that you could never see in your hometown. The big purpose of that is generally gone now. We have interleague play. We have every team available on our streaming service or on cable TV. And so that leaves one thing, and that is marketing. On Tuesday night, those of us who care will watch the Major League Baseball All-Star Game presented by MasterCard. It will be preceded by the Gatorade All-Star Workout Day on Monday, featuring the T-Mobile Home Run Derby. All of these players are participants were chosen, by the way, by Esurance fan voting and the Esurance All-Star Final Vote. Hashtag, hashtag, hashtag. But wait, there's more. There are Little League Field Refurbishment Program sponsored by Scotts. There is a 5K sponsored by Nike. There is a group yoga event sponsored by something called SoPose. The All-Star Game has become nothing but a vehicle for Major League Baseball to partner up with its corporate sponsors. I think we'd be better served at this point if they just wrote checks, gave all the players a few days off, and let us all come back next weekend for fresh, actual, meaningful baseball.
The only thing that I see in favor of the Major League All-Star Game is that it's not as gimmicky as the other All-Star Games out there. I mean, I can't even keep track of what the NHL is doing now. Who plays whom? Is it Europe versus the U.S., U.S. versus Canada with some Europeans thrown in there? Are we doing it by league? Are we doing it by conference? Are we doing it old guys versus young guys? I have no idea what's going on in the NHL. The only thing that Major League Baseball has going for it is that it's an actual game, and they decide home field advantage for the World Series, which is a very bad idea. Exactly, I was going to say, which is a whole other topic for discussion because it's so unfair to teams from both leagues.
The only issue I would take with Craig is that I don't know that we should be surprised. We've reached a point where everything is sponsored by a corporation. The list of bowl games and their sponsors used to be funny, and then it became routine. It's not even funny anymore that
tragic.
There's a Tostitos bowl game. I didn't even get a laugh anymore.
I'm going. That's the thing. Despite all of my hate that I'm throwing on the All-Star Game, I am professionally obligated to get on a plane, so I don't know. It'll still be fun, even though it's silly.
Shira, you're next, and I understand that you would like to talk about the money changing hands between NBA teams and various free agents over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit it, but there's been an ABBA song in my head for most of this week. You're probably familiar with this song, Money, Money, Money. For example, you have Chandler Parsons, who got a four-year, $94 million deal from the Memphis Grizzlies, but his teammate, Mike Conley, his future teammate, got $153 million for 5 years from the Grizzlies. That means that next season, Conley will make more than twice as much as two-time league MVP Steph Curry. But the bigger picture that I'm concerned about is, what does this mean for the NBA? What happens when you have a player who's making lots of dough and is not getting the playing time that he expected to get when he signed his big contract? And I fear that NBA coaches are ultimately going to be the ones who pay down the line.
Craig, are you similarly worried that money will ruin the National Basketball Association?
No, for another ABBA song reason. That's the name of the game. The revenue is the revenue. The owners aren't writing these checks unless the owners can cover them. And any dollar that doesn't go to a player goes into an owner's pocket. Maybe the optics right now are a little bit weird. When the superstars like Steph Curry or LeBron James or anybody like that are making less than some of these journeymen, it is a bit weird. Now, a lot of that is timing. I think if Steph Curry was out in the market right now in the same level that some of these other guys were, he'd be making more, no doubt. But all you got to do is give LeBron James or somebody like him that kind of power. He basically built his team in Cleveland and called all the shots this year and won a championship. So why
not? He got rid of his coach, David Blatt.
You know, markets determine price, and that's why hedge fund managers make more in a week than everybody in the Eastern Seaboard who works at McDonald's makes in a lifetime. It's outrageous, it's not fair, and it's also what happens in a country where your value is measured by your salary and how much income you are able to generate. It's not like the players are going to these team owners, general managers, et cetera, and forcing them to do this. These are decisions that management is making. And so whatever ill happens as a result of these things is hardly on the players. That's how this business operates. My story involves Calvin Johnson, who recently retired from the National Football League. He's only 30 years old. He's been good enough so that he earned the nickname Megatron, which is pretty cool,
yeah.
I got to say, even though I'm not a big NFL fan. Johnson said in an interview this week that when he wakes up in the morning, he can't walk. Also said that during much of his career, pain medication like Vicodin was given out, quote, like candy by the team trainers. And he said he had no idea how many concussions he'd suffered, but he guessed that probably a couple per game or something along that line. He is, of course, far from the first player to retire young from the NFL. We've seen it a lot in recent years. But I'm wondering whether this kind of story has simply become routine. We report these stories just like we report mini camps and the draft and which coaches are being fired and which ones are being hired. And in a way, that strikes me as not only terribly sad, but utterly irresponsible. People should be paying more attention to the fact that these guys are damaged.
Yeah, I'm with you. It has become a very uncomfortable feeling that this is business as usual. Painkillers have been distributed like candy for a very, very, very long time. This is not a recent development, especially in this day and age when there's so much conversation about how opioid-laced painkillers lead to opioid addiction. Where is the NFL? What are they doing about this besides paying lip service to this?
Unfortunately, what the NFL is doing is nothing for a reason. This is a feature, not a bug, of professional football these days. These guys are interchangeable. They are modern gladiators. Their careers are very short. Fans don't care. Someone else will be wearing that uniform soon and a black visor over their face mask where we can't even see their faces. And what happens to them is generally beside the point for most NFL fans. The league knows this. The league has made a lot of money off of this. And frankly, there is no incentive whatsoever for the NFL to change.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Shira Springer of the Boston Globe and Craig Calcaterra of NBCSports.com. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
There's lots more Only a Game to come, but when you get a chance, please leave your comments about the program on iTunes and rate us. That way, all podcasters everywhere will know we're available.
You know, I grew up around country music. My fondest memories as a child were sitting beside my grandfather listening to him play the fiddle. And so we have a band called Theo Fleury and the Death Valley Rebels, and we just got off our first tour, and you know, we sort of have our own sound. We call it hockey tonk instead of honky tonk.
Woke up with my head between the bed and wall. Another night of emptiness witnessed by all. Find my clothes, stumble my way home. Back to my reality where I stand alone.
And the songs are all about struggle and recovery. And I would say the majority of people that are in my audience are, you know, are trauma survivors. And so the message is the same. Doesn't matter whether I speak or write a book or sing about it. You know, the message is always the same about hope and healing and recovery and making a comeback in life.
Theo Fleury hasn't always wanted to be a country singer. In 2003, after 15 seasons in the NHL, Fleury was in training for the last season on his $4.5 million contract with the Chicago Blackhawks. He was also working his way through a 12-step program trying to overcome years of alcoholism and drug addiction. Fleury's career hadn't always gone the way he'd hoped it would go. The drugs and alcohol had something to do with that. But he had no idea that his biggest challenge was still ahead of him. He tells us that story in his own words.
About halfway through my workout one day, I pressed the stop button on the treadmill, and that was it. I quit. Didn't call the Blackhawks, didn't call my agent. I just sort of disappeared off the face of the earth. I say that I probably went on the bender of all benders. You know, I had about a $3,500 a week cocaine habit. I was buying alcohol by the case, and it wasn't too long after that that I tried to commit suicide, but even though I had a fully loaded pistol in my mouth, you know, I couldn't pull the trigger. And, you know, that event is, you know, something that I look back at as, you know, maybe a turning point in my life. I said, you know, please, please, God, take away the obsession to drink and do drugs. And I looked in the mirror and can't really remember the last time I looked at myself in the eye, and, you know, so I sort of sat and stared at myself, and I think it was about 40 minutes into it where I finally looked at myself and I went, holy cow, my prayer was answered. And that was September 18th of 2005, and I haven't had a drink or a drug since that time, and so that was pretty profound mourning, that's for sure. I couldn't have possibly known at the time the impact that, you know, writing Playing with Fire would turn out to be. And as I started the book, there was really no intention of putting that stuff in the book initially. But, you know, by the time the book was finished, you know, I hadn't left anything out. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom was a prescription pill addict. And so there was a lot of chaos in my life. And then from the time I was 14 to 16, I was raped 150 times by a coach of mine. Obviously, to deal with my own emotional pain and suffering, you know, I sort of gravitated to the dark side of life, you know, became an alcoholic and a drug addict. So after I wrote the book, about 4 days before I was going to Toronto to launch Playing with Fire, I sort of kind of sat back and I went, you know, what have I just done here? Because I didn't know how everybody was going to react to what was in the book. And so I was very afraid. And, you know, so I showed up at the first book signing in Toronto. 400 people showed up at this book signing, and I'm like, this is strange. You know, I'm not J.K. Rowling. I didn't write Harry Potter, or, you know, I'm not Wayne Gretzky or whatever. And I thought it was really strange that many people would show up. So I start signing books, and out of the corner of my eye, I spot a guy in line. He's got my book clutched against his chest, and his face is buried in the floor, and he's walking really slow. And so I follow him all the way in the line. He gets to the front of the line. He sets the book on the table. He looks me in the eye and says, "Me too." I'll never forget his face as long as I live. What I realized was how much courage and strength it took for him to get to that book signing. And as much as he needed to say "me too," you know, I needed to hear it so that I didn't feel alone, he didn't feel alone. And really, since that first "me too," basically I haven't stopped. I think at the beginning I was so willing to help people that it was overwhelming and there was too many to help. And whenever I had to attach any emotion to my words, you know, I would sort of be anxious and I couldn't sit still, and I'd get up and I'd walk around and I'd pace. Her name is Kim Barthel. We were both asked to speak at this conference on resilience. She was the keynote speaker in the afternoon and I was the keynote speaker in the evening. And most times when I go to an event and I'm asked to speak in the evening, I will spend, you know, that time resting and relaxing in my room. But something said to me I should go downstairs and listen to this speaker. You know, she's a neuroscientist with a background in childhood trauma. She put up a couple of videos on the screen. One of a healthy mom and baby in relationship and one of an unhealthy baby and mom in relationship. And that triggered me. You know, I had focused so much of my recovery on the sexual abuse that happened in my life that I forgot about watching my parents in their own addictions. It was really all of that that sort of led me to this predator, right? Who ended up, like I said, you know, raping me 150 times. And so if we're going to peel all of the layers of the onion off, which we have to do in the therapeutic process, you know, I had to start to take a look at that. So when she was done speaking, I was like, you know what, I need to meet this woman. So I sort of went up to her and I said, "Hey, you," I said, "you just changed my life." And I said, "I think you'll be working with me for the rest of your life." And, you know, we sat around my kitchen table for 72 hours and chatted to one another. And at the end of the 72 hours, I realized there wasn't one thing I could have changed about my life to make it any different, which finally took away all that shame and all that guilt and responsibility that I thought that I had. It was truly one of those light bulb moments where I was able to sort of start to forgive myself. You know, here we are 4 years later and the two of us have written a book, and we've worked with everybody from sexual abuse victims to foster kids to people in the Army who've suffered PTSD to firefighters. You know, it's just it's an amazing friendship. You know, I always thought that I was meant to be a hockey player, but at the end of the day, this is the work that I was chosen to do, and it's brought me a lot of peace and happiness and joy.
I now have the life I always dreamed of. My head is held high. I like looking people in the eyes. My past will always be a part of me.
That's former NHL player Theo Fleury. Our story was produced by Martin Kessler and mixed by George Hicks in collaboration with Sports Illustrated, which profiled Theo Fleury in their 2016 Where Are They Now issue, available now. We'll be bringing you more stories from Sports Illustrated's Where Are They Now special issue in the next few weeks, but you can hear them first at si.com/WATN. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Next week on the show, we'll have the story of former boxer Christy Martin, who in her post-pugilistic career speaks out against violence. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a candidate for champion of current novels titled Champion of the World. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
In the aftermath of the death of Philando Castile in Minnesota and several police officers in Dallas, Carmelo Anthony of the New York Knicks urged athletes everywhere to demand change without resorting to violence. You think athletes are going to heed this call?
Well, they are. Some of them already have, I mean, at least on social media. This is interesting coming from Carmelo Anthony, who first came to off-court fame by appearing in a Stop Snitching video with some of his friends back in Baltimore.
Right.
Yes, this should happen. Yes, there is a rising political awareness, I think, among the young athletes today, and I think it's all to the good.
NBA free agent relocation has been underway for some time. The biggest name among the very wealthy signees, of course, is Kevin Durant. He'll be with the Golden State Warriors next season, and maybe the next one, too. Who knows? Is he a coward, a traitor, a bum, and a cheat for leaving Oklahoma City? Because he's been called all of those things.
Yeah.
The last two by Charles Barkley.
Yeah, well, Charles Barkley has many opinions, and at least 22.3% of them are worth listening to. Look, I'm sorry Kevin Durant went to the Warriors for a number of reasons, including the selfish, because it was possible that he could end up with the Celtics. So I am very selfish about the Celtics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm becoming a radio pro because I was able to get that out without spitting on you.
Excellent.
Over
here.
Yeah, thank you. But it's going to be worth it for the league to have this team for people to shoot at. And frankly, I don't know what you want in the pool for the date on which Draymond Green throws his first hissy fit because he's not getting the ball enough, because I will guarantee you that will happen. And anybody who thinks that this move will go smoothly for the Warriors is kidding themselves.
The disassembling of the Miami Heat, assembled to win a championship or two just a few years ago, proceeds apace. Dwayne Wade will be in Chicago next season. Wasn't he supposed to be a lifelong member of the Heat?
Well, yeah, but he also grew up in Chicago, and this is a pretty nice move for him, too. You know, he's had a great career in Miami, and he wants to go back home and play a couple of years in front of his hometown fans, and I don't have a problem with that either.
Do the Bulls get suddenly much better?
They get okay. I don't know that they get a lot better, but they get okay.
The Major League All-Star Game is coming up on Tuesday. Anything from either roster leaping out at you, except that the entire infield is the Chicago Cubs?
Yes, if they all, it's going to be a really bad day for, and believe me, if it was anybody but the Cubs, I wouldn't make this suggestion. But when the entire infield collides under a pop fly and they all tear their knee ligaments, it's going to be a really bad day for Cubs fans.
No, this is the year.
Not only that, by the way, but 2/3 of the American League outfield is made up of your Boston Red Sox.
That's right. Because they can do everything except pitch.
Well, they've won the World Championship, so none of that stuff counts anymore.
I was kind of amazed by the uniforms these guys are going to be wearing. Brown and yellow. It's kind of a throwback to the San Diego Padres. And it reminds me of when Steve Garvey went from the Dodgers to the Padres, and he looked at himself in the mirror in the Padres clubhouse on day one and said, "I look like a taco."
These things are exactly like the old Padres uniforms, right down to the font on the hats and the jerseys. They also look like, you know, a beer league softball team. That's from Pewaukee, Wisconsin.
Former Green Bay Packers running back Paul Hornung is the latest to sue helmet maker Riddell. The 80-year-old Hornung, now suffering from dementia, claims that the football helmets he wore failed to protect him from brain injury. Players might now know the risks involved in playing pro football, but is it safe to say that Hornung, who played in the 50s and the 60s, would not have known these risks?
I think that's going to be the hinge on which this entire case turns. What he knew about the risks he was taking, if anything at all, while he was playing, and what Riddell knew about the capability of its equipment to protect him from those risks. Now, I'm not entirely sure. Hornung's lawyer said that there are studies dating back to the 19th century that show that head trauma can lead to permanent brain damage, which I guess ought not to surprise anyone. But if you're going to look for how this lawsuit goes forward, if it goes forward, it's going to be on those 2 points.
I have to mention this week that Lionel Messi and his father were convicted of tax fraud. You don't care, right? Neither do I.
Throw him in jail.
Move on.
Throw away the key. No, apparently he's
not going to jail.
Apparently he's been sentenced to 21 months, which is below the cutoff line by which you actually have to serve your sentence in a jail.
Mm-hmm.
So he's sentenced to 21 months in jail, but he's not going to do a day.
Good. Finally, Charlie, here's an answer to what do you give the man who has everything if that man is Kobe Bryant? Snoop Dogg.
His story is already great, by the way.
Gave Kobe Bryant a car. And the car features portraits of great L.A. Lakers past and present, and also Snoop. Do you suppose Bryant will ever actually drive this magnificently inconspicuous vehicle out of his driveway?
Because I believe in America, Bill. I hope so. I hope he drives it to, like, the mini mart to get a taco. I hope he drives it to the fruit stand to buy a cantaloupe. I hope he drives it to his kid's soccer game. I'm telling you, I hope he drives it to the dentist.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins me each week as well here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
According to some, NBA basketball is a sort of ballet featuring very tall guys. To commentator Mike Pesca, it's like something else entirely.
The NFL might be our national sport as measured by revenue, attention, TV ratings, but in the last month, the NBA has demonstrated that it's our national sporting story. After an okay, not exactly gripping college draft, free agency hit like a LeBron James chase down block or a Draymond Green shot to the, you know what, let's go with the LeBron analogy. Anyway, whatever happens between, I don't know, November and February in the Gardens or the Palaces or the Centers, Staples, Toyota, or Smoothie King, it won't be nearly as fascinating as what happened in 1 week in July emanating from one house in the Hamptons. But the reason that the NBA is a great story goes beyond the fact that the NBA is the setting, the backdrop for a bunch of exciting things. The NBA adheres to story structure of birth and rebirth, or the hero's journey, of the exiled favorite son who returns to lead his troops. That's LeBron James. Then there are the gunslingers, and there are plenty of anti-heroes. What the NBA actually is most like is that great American confluence of athleticism and storyline. Wrestling. Professional wrestling. The WWE pits good guys against bad guys. They fight each other in the ring, but the whole time they're stoking the storylines away from the ring. And occasionally, a good guy will turn bad. In wrestling, it's known as a heel turn. Lots of fans, especially ones waiting on hold to talk to the hosts of sports radio, regard Kevin Durant as having taken a heel turn. And you could argue that babyface Steph Curry, literally nicknamed the Babyface Assassin, began his heel turn when he threw his mouthpiece into the crowd after Game 6, lost Game 7, and subverted the Gladiators' code by accepting assistance from his fiercest rival. Now, I don't think any of those interpretations are actually accurate, by the way, but I think they do play as mythic storylines, and I think they'll be fueling the NBA all the way through WrestleMania 33. Wait, I mean the NBA Finals.
Mike Pesca hosts the daily podcast The Gist from Slate. He's a panelist on the sports podcast Hang Up and Listen, which posts every Monday.
The clowns came to get him when it was time for the hanging.
That's Chad Dundas reading from the first chapter of his new novel about a wrestler turned circus performer.
The clowns came to get him when it was time for the hanging. He met them outside his trailer, a half dozen of them, all dressed like cops, looking soiled and road-weary in their baggy blue uniforms, soda siphons hanging from their belts instead of guns and cuffs. No one spoke as they walked him down to the gallows, moving through the narrow alleys between the powerhouse trucks, costume tents, and animal cages, heading for the spot on the infield grass where the white tops of the Carnival's 7 performance pavilions lifted like billowing clouds. The horn players blasted out a ta-da as the clowns pulled back the curtain. They all walked out together, blinded for a moment by the heat and light. The polite applause turned to cheers as Pepper suddenly burst free of the clowns, sending them toppling in a heap, and jogged around the ring, raising a hand to wave at everyone and no one. As he came to the front, he whipped off his cape and gave them all a good look at him in just his boots and wrestling tights. He was a small man, all bone and gristle, his legs a little too short, his arms a little too long. His neck was so thick and powerful that it seemed to swallow up his shoulders. Cords of muscle rippled in it as he turned his head one way, then the other. Without warning, he spun and bent backward, balancing like a crab on the crown of his head, rolling and stretching his neck from side to side before kipping up to his feet. One of the stagehands came forward with a pair of handcuffs, holding them up for all to see, drawing the appropriate oohs and ahs as he jerked Pepper's arms behind his back and led him around to the gallows. Once they'd climbed the steps to the platform, Boyd Markham strolled over, silver hair and dark suit shining, microphone now cupped in his hand.
"Mr. Van Dien," he said, "any final words?" "Well?"
Pepper said, voice cracking so badly he had to clear his throat and begin again.
"Well, I'd just like to say,"
taking some time to think it over,
"God bless America. I hope that everyone had a great 4th of July, and if I don't see you, have a good Thanksgiving, a Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year, too."
Some chuckles from the crowd.
"Is that all?"
Markham asked, a tease in his voice. Pepper swallowed hard.
"Anybody got a drink?"
It was late August, 1921, and Prohibition jokes killed. One of the stagehands produced another black hood from his pocket and tugged it over Pepper's head, his world suddenly flushed into darkness before dragging him back a few steps to the middle of the platform, his feet stumbling and scraping across the wood. Inside the hood, it smelled like mildew and old sweat. Though he couldn't see, he knew by heart what happened next. The stagehands stood him on his mark and slipped the noose, fat and deadly, over his head. Two more men in executioner's hoods brought torches out from the back and planted them in the dirt on either side of the gallows. The spotlights dimmed and the torches bathed them all in a pale glow.
"Enough pretense," Markham announced. "Shall we put this man out of his misery?"
The crowd cheered.
"Okay, boys,"
he said to the stagehands.
"Let's do it."
Pepper sucked in a gulp of air and held it, pinching his eyes shut. He couldn't hear the crowd or the rumble of the powerhouse trucks or the crackle of the torches, just his own breathing inside the hood. Footsteps moved across the platform as the stagehands approached a large red lever at one side of the gallows. He drew himself up as straight as he could, locking the muscles in his neck, back, and shoulders, imagining Markham raising a hand to shoulder level, holding the crowd's attention like Caesar deciding the fate of a defeated gladiator. Long moments now. And he cleared his mind, thinking only, as he always did, of Moira's face, just as Markham chopped his hand downward with a dramatic twist. The stagehands pulled the lever and the trapdoor fell out from under him. He dropped like a shot, 3 feet, and jerked stiff. The tent quiet, except for the clatter of the trapdoor and snap of the rope. The horn players blasted out another triumphant ta-da, but Pepper didn't move. A few moments of murmured confusion passed, and then the players tooted it again, ta-da, nothing. His body just hung there still. Whispers spread through the audience as the stagehands ran down the steps and under the platform. Markham jogged over. "What the hell is going on?" he demanded. Another group of stagehands sprinted out carrying a stretcher, trailed by a man in a white doctor's coat, a black bag in his hand. Markham leapt up and tore off Pepper's hood, revealing his pallid, frozen face. A horrified gasp echoed through the stadium. Parents covered their children's eyes. Men grumbled to each other, not sure if they should get up and leave. Then the stage lights winked out, leaving only the rippling torches. Somewhere far off, an elephant trumpeted. In the dark, a woman screamed.
That's Chad Dundas reading from the first chapter of his new novel. It's called Champion of the World, and if you'd read as many disappointing books set in sports as I have, you would understand my excitement at finding the real thing. And as it turns out, the hangman's drop, the stunt performed in Chapter 1 by Pepper Van Dien, formerly wrestling's lightweight champion of the world, was a real thing, too. For his novel, Dundas researched the stunt, as well as the world of wrestling 100 years ago.
It's a little bit difficult to find accounts of the blow-by-blow of how it went during those carnival performances, and especially difficult to find accounts that are credible in any way. But it is a performance that was actually accomplished by wrestlers, and one of the most famous practitioners of it was a guy by the name of Martin Farmer Burns, who was a very prominent wrestling trainer in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Credible or not, accounts of Burns and his hangman's drop are compelling.
Martin Farmer Burns was a small man of about 160 pounds, and as the legend goes, he became so enraged at himself for allowing an opponent to defeat him in a wrestling match via choke that he devised a system for training his neck and training the muscles of his throat to the point that he was able to, at least allegedly, withstand a 12-inch drop from a platform with a noose around his neck and then was able to hang for 1 minute and whistle Yankee Doodle Dandy.
You're going to have to read the book if you want to know whether Pepper Van Dien, that fictional character created by Dundas, survives the hangman's drop. Champion of the World will be released on Tuesday. In the meantime, you can read more of my conversation with Chad Dundas on onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our intern is Ian Foster. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from Champion of the World author Chad Dundas, who offers this job description of wrestler.
I believe Pepper Van Dien says at some point during the book, you're the world's fattest ballet dancer.
Or maybe ballet dancers are just really slender wrestlers. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.